ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
One way or another, NATO's pretty kaput, but the idea that Donald Trump would sort of officially say, well, we're walking away, would just have the most dire ramifications for all of Europe and the rest of us.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. Well, last week was the last episode of our Black Swans series, looking at how we predict the future and why we get it so wrong. If you caught the last episode, I hope you enjoyed it. And if you haven't seen it yet, please check it out. It's up on YouTube and on iView now. We did a lot of fancy production on it. It's worth looking at. In the final episode, I spoke to cognitive psychologist and science writer Steven Pinker about doomsday predictions and why it's easier to be a cynic than an optimist. Steven and I chatted for about an hour, and we covered a lot of ground that didn't make the final cut of Black Swans, but it was a fascinating conversation. So I thought I'd share it with you here. I hope you enjoy it. Stephen, thank you so much for talking to us about this topic. I really enjoy your writing over the last few books. It's made me feel a little bit more optimistic about the world than the doomsday clock does, for example. I'd be interested in starting with that because, as you write in Enlightenment Now, if a clock has been set at 2 minutes to midnight for 75 years, then there's something wrong with the clock. What do you think it does to us to constantly be told that we're 2 minutes away from doom?
Ironically, the doomsday clock as an image does the opposite to what its intent would be, which is to wake up the world to the danger of nuclear annihilation, the better that it should act to prevent it. But a clock just ticks down. You know, unless you smash the clock, it's going to keep going. So the clock is really a rather awful metaphor for the idea that our future is in our hands.
That's very true. And the fact that they have been occasionally, you know, winding the clock backwards as though that's some sort of a daylight saving adjustment. When the Cold War ends, wind your clock back 17 minutes.
To their credit, they did that, but generally they try to move it closer and closer, and their problem now is they're running out of room, particularly since even in the first decades of the 21st century, well, I should say the 1990s in particular, there are some reasons to think that the world was safer than it was at the height of the Cold War. After all, one of the two adversaries had gone out of existence, and there had been arms control agreements they'd signed. They switched definition of doomsday, so it was no longer a thermonuclear war, but now it was overpopulation and resource shortages and climate change. So they found some new reasons that we're all doomed. I don't know if they have yet added takeover by malevolent or accidental AI, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was coming.
I've come across a clip from our ABC archive from 1980 of the strategic studies professor Jeffrey Lee Williams, who says that fear of nuclear war is overstated.
Undoubtedly, it's been exaggerated because the Western powers have developed theories of deterrence. And to deter war, you maximize the impact that war would have, or at least you create the impression that war would be of a disastrous character.
Do you think that's the theory behind not just the doomsday clock, but a lot of US officials often talk about the terrifying threat of nuclear war? And, you know, Donald Trump talks about various things that he is concerned will begin World War III. Is that part of the deterrence strategy, do you think?
There are two different senses of deterrence here. One of them is deterring adversaries, that is, deterring, say, Kim Jong-un from launching an unprovoked strike on the United States or Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping. And that's generally what deterrence refers to. There, it's not so much that it has to be unspeakably awful, but it's got to be bad enough that they wouldn't attempt it. More important, it has to be certain. And that's why a large part of a nuclear strategy was making sure that the deterrent capability was invulnerable. That is, it would be impossible to take out our ability to retaliate. Now, there's a second kind of deterrence that I think your question alludes to, and that is not so much deterrence because the public can't launch its own nuclear weapon, but rather fear of somehow trying to get out of this hole system, this literally MAD system, MAD being the acronym for Mutually Assured Destruction, which has been the basis of nuclear strategy since the 1960s, that the populace, to the extent that the populace has a say, which of course it doesn't in China or Russia, but in democratic countries like Britain, France, the United States, they would not elect governments that would be tempted to launch its own first strike because they would be fearful of the retaliation from the other side.
Yes, it's sort of a self-deterrence, I suppose. Professor Williams goes on to say that he thinks that the Western powers have gone too far with this form of deterrence.
And in the end, it becomes self-defeating because it makes any kind of provision by way of protective measures for the population seem irrational, unnecessary, even dangerous.
It basically creates a sense of fatalism amongst people. Do you think that is something that this whole 75-year process of nuclear deterrence has created in a lot of people?
I think that really is a danger, that if you pile on the doomsday scenarios, if nuclear war doesn't wipe us all out, then climate change will, and if that doesn't, then it'll be rogue artificial intelligence. At some point, people would just say, to hell with it, if we're doomed, I may as well enjoy life now. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And I think people ought to be more aware of the fact that there has been a significant amount of nuclear disarmament. A number of countries have given up their nuclear weapon programs. South Africa, Sweden, Argentina had them. The sheer nuclear stockpile, though still terrifying, is a fraction of what it was at the height of the Cold War. And that we haven't had nuclear testing for many decades. We haven't had atmospheric nuclear testing since the early 1960s. It seems like a distant memory, but it wasn't that long ago, around 2007, 2008, that there was talk of global zero, of eliminating every last nuclear weapon. It's an idea we should keep in the back of our minds because it is not a dream.
Yes.
There are feasible pathways for getting there.
It's interesting, still, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are walking around with a briefcase following them everywhere they go that could theoretically be used to launch all of their country's nuclear weapons at a moment's notice. And yet you've made the point that the fact that they have a nuclear triad, the fact that they have nuclear weapons in lots of different places, effectively makes that pointless. There's no situation where one side could totally wipe out the other side's nuclear capabilities in a matter of hours. So you might as well wait and think about it before you fire your nuclear weapons.
Well, yes, and we are living in without sufficient safeguards to the nightmare scenario in which, say, a leader is informed. We've detected a launch. We've got 20 minutes before all our cities will be incinerated. You have a few minutes to make the decision as to whether to retaliate now for what's going to be an inevitability. You really want to lengthen that fuse because the proverbial flock of seagulls or solar reflections, could in principle, and we have come not close, but too close for comfort to such false alarms in the past. So if anything is a no-brainer, it would be lengthening the fuse, minimizing to as close to zero as possible that there would be a launch based on a misunderstanding or a false alarm.
Life for most people today, as you've talked about, is on so many metrics better than at any point in history. We live longer, we're healthier for longer, we are less likely to die in a violent way or experience violence in any way at all. But it's common to feel that the world is in a terrible shape. At least this seems to be a common feeling in much of the West. Why do you think that is? And why do you think this has lingered for such a long time, despite things getting consistently better?
Yeah, so a lot of progress that you refer to is invisible. It's simply, it either consists of things that haven't happened, that therefore don't make the news, like parts of the world that are at peace. When there's a war, it's news. When there's nothing happening, it's almost by definition not news. And if more and more areas of the world are ones where nothing happens, you just can't read about it because it didn't happen on a Thursday in October. Also, some of the progress that's taken place creeps up a few percentage points a year, such as the decline in extreme poverty, the increase in longevity. And so, once again, it doesn't happen on a Thursday in October at 9:17 a.m. And so it's not news. These are built-in biases that just come from the very nature of news, because news is a about stuff that happens. And in addition, there's also, for not just journalists, but pundits, artists, commentators, social critics, there's a gravitas, a kind of seriousness that comes with pointing out the negative. You seem more like a prophet, whereas to point out the progress, you seem more like an apologist or naive, or to use the various epithets that I've heard, a pangloss, a cheerleader, Pollyanna. Mm. There's a built-in honor or credit that people get toward being social critics rather than observers of what's going right.
Yeah, as part of this series, we've looked a little bit into Paul Ehrlich, the well-known population doomsdayer, and the fact that, you know, he's still regarded by many people as a very eminent, brave, and long-standing hero of conservationism, despite the fact that almost every single one of his predictions that he's ever made have proven to be catastrophically, well, not catastrophically, because things have turned out fine, but quite wrong.
Catastrophically from the point of view of the predictor, not of humanity.
Yes,
but
yes.
It's true that some of the great fears that I grew up with, including overpopulation, resource shortages, nuclear war between the superpowers, is still something to be concerned about. But the idea that the Soviet Union would launch a first strike, now there is no Soviet Union, so that helps. And again, we do come up with new existential risks or fears to replace them, of which artificial intelligence is probably the most prominent one now.
Yes.
Now, and again, noting that some of these fears don't come to pass, and for reasons that were not appreciated at the time, but we certainly appreciate now. The fact, for example, that thanks to advances in agronomy, food production has spectacularly increased, so the massive famines that were predicted never came to pass. Thanks to changes in social values and mores, particularly the empowerment of women, population explosion gets diffused in every country that has an increase in affluence, in education, and women's rights. The human imagination tends to extrapolate and not to take into account the feedback, the corrective measures that often are implemented when we do go too far in a particular direction. We also the human mind tends to think far too much in terms of stuff and not enough in terms of information or ideas. The idea that we're going to run out of copper and steel just assumes that we need copper, but you know, we don't actually need copper. We need ways of transmitting information, and we need things to make pots and pans out of. We need to cook our food. Who knows what materials we may need in the future? It's ultimately ideas that are the source of prosperity. Ideas aren't made out of stuff, and there's an infinite space of ideas that we have yet to tap. And that's something that predictions of the future tend to underestimate, namely how much of the space of ideas remains unexplored.
Bill Gates, who I know is a big fan of yours, recently said, although climate change will have serious consequences, particularly for people in the poorest countries, it will not lead to humanity's demise. People will be able to live and thrive in most places on Earth for the foreseeable future. He's been criticized for this by a lot of climate experts who say that he's downplaying the threat and the importance of the clean energy transition. Donald Trump also jumped on the comments as an opportunity to say that climate change is a hoax. Do you think that Bill Gates saying things like he's said in this statement undermines the efforts to decarbonize the economy and to address climate change? If we don't think that it is a existential crisis for humanity, will we act more slowly?
This would have to be studied. Since I'm an experimental psychologist, I'm often wary of saying how people will be affected by such and such a thing, and before we actually go out and get a sample of people and see how they'll react. But it's at least as likely that people will, in fact, be more receptive to decarbonization if they, first of all, think that it's not a question of whether we're doomed. Things can really suck short of our being going out of existence. And so even being worried about things like really, really sucking can themselves be motivators. But also, if the message is we've got to radically change our lifestyle, we've got to deindustrialize, we've got to get back to living in tents and shiver in the cold and give up, you know, beef and transportation and never fly again, people are going to say, well, I'll take my chances. But if the emphasis is not on abstinence, of degrowth, of sacrifices, but rather acknowledging that energy is good, that we're not going to realistically give up fossil fuel energy until we have a replacement, particularly in poorer countries. They probably shouldn't give up fossil fuel energy because that's all they're going to have for a while, and that the consequences of human suffering are going to be worse staying poor than the contribution they'll make to climate change. That's how I understand his message. So it's a somewhat subtle message. It's not, you know, don't worry. It's, first of all, don't panic. And he said that in response to changed projections from the climate models, which acknowledge that we are in for warming, there's no question about it, but the kind of catastrophic warming that we worried about a couple of decades ago does seem less likely, which is not to say that we can relax. We definitely can. Bad things could happen. Bad things will happen unless we decarbonize. But we've got to adjust the balance of decarbonization so it doesn't keep poor people in extreme poverty. Also, since just in terms of, do we have a prayer? Are we really going to decarbonize? If the answer is yes, we'll decarbonize by keeping the developing world in extreme poverty and returning the developed world to poverty, then yeah, we're doomed. That's just not going to happen. We're not going to do it. Mm. If, on the other hand, the path forward is, let's innovate and make clean energy cheaper than dirty energy, so people acting in their own interests will opt for clean energy. That will not bring climate change to a halt, simply because a lot of it is baked in by the CO2 that's already emitted. But that will slow it down. That will also give us perhaps the means to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere, which most experts say we have to do as well. That should be our path forward. Innovation that gives us lots and lots of clean energy.
It's an interesting balancing act, I suppose, between making people aware of threats without making people fatalistic and assume that something is inevitable. It's a tricky balancing act that we don't seem to be able to do very well, and we haven't been able to do very well for a long time. We sent you clips of these letters that we've come across from 1959 from a number of eminent Australian commentators and writers and priests and teachers. In these letters, where they seem quite terrified of nuclear war, many of them, what do you take out of those letters? What do those letters tell you?
I was actually rather surprised that, at least in the sample that I was sent, there's a fair amount of optimism that was expressed.
There is, yes.
I was prepared to see letters saying, I'm not going to be, there's no point in my writing this letter because you're all going to be extinct anyway. There aren't going to be any of you around. None of them had that, and a lot of them actually forecasted rather positive developments, an end to war, a list, an end to prejudice, some of them with fantastical means to get there, such as a world government or re-engineering human brains so that they're incapable of prejudice and bigotry and hatred. But I was actually surprised with what in retrospect seems a kind of innocent, by our standards, optimism. Mm. And I think that we perhaps should appreciate how much of a disillusionment the 1960s brought. It was also the era, of course, of the counterculture, of a cynicism about Western democracies and Western technology as sources of human betterment. And I think we've been living with some of that gloom ever since.
I want to ask you finally, some of the letter writers note, in particular, the only woman that the ABC asked to write a letter was Ellen Christensen, and she notes that she thinks that while our surroundings and technologies and the circumstances of our lives may change, the real fact of being a human and the experience of being a human doesn't really change that much. She says she feels like she has plenty in common with the women of Troy. And another writer says that he has a grandfather who was in the Battle of Waterloo, and he feels like his life is not all that different in the realities of humanity than that. Do you agree with that perception?
I think those are wise observations, that human nature doesn't change, and to dream of a utopia in which there will be no conflict and strife is not only naive, but it could actually be dangerous, because it means that actual flesh and blood humans are nuisances that have to be reprogrammed, or if they're resistant to reprogramming, eliminated. And that was what was behind some of the worst dystopias that did come to pass, namely in Maoist China and Stalinist Russia. There was the idea of a new Soviet man, which led to the totalitarian regimes that were specifically designed to reprogram new generations and led to utter atrocities. You know, on the other hand, there can be, even though I'm a staunch believer in the existence of human nature, I wrote a book called The Blank Slate on the fact that human nature is here to stay. I'm also a believer in the possibility of progress, not of utopia, not of perfection, but there are enough problems that we really always can do better. We can have fewer people dying of preventable diseases. We can have fewer poor people. We can have strife consisting of, you know, comments on social media comment sections rather than duels with pistols or gang wars, let alone actual wars between countries. So there's tremendous scope for improvement because human nature is not a fixed set of reflexes. It includes an open-ended ability to think new thoughts, solve problems, bend the trade-offs. It includes an expandable sense of empathy. Nonetheless, I do think that those letter writers were wise in predicting that we'll still be stuck with humans with all of our biases and flaws, and that however much improvement there will be, there will never be perfection because of the flawed creatures that we are.
Do you ever try and predict the future, Stephen? Do you try and stay away from it as much as possible?
I try to stay away from the discovery that the world's best forecasters, the so-called super forecasters, who take every scrap of data, who avoid every one of the biases that you and I have been talking about in this conversation, try to be as absolutely objective as possible, their predictions fall to chance within about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're better than typical columnists, they're better than politicians, they're better than anyone. And that's the best that we can do, at least so far. So I am chastened by that, and I am leery of making predictions, although I'm willing to talk about possibilities.
Yes, and probabilities maybe. Stephen, I really appreciate your time. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and it's made me feel more optimistic about the world, and I think that's something that is a very valuable thing these days. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for having me.
Steven Pinker is touring this corner of the planet this week, coming to Auckland, Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney. This is the end of our Black Swan series for now. If you want to listen to the 1959 Letters to the Unborn in full, they're available now on the ABC website. There's a link in today's show notes. And yes, you may have noticed that last Thursday I said that this episode would be coming out on Tuesday, but it's here now, on Sunday. And if that doesn't prove how terrible we are at predicting the future, I don't know what will. Can't even predict our own production schedule. The reason the episode is out early is because a week after Stephen's tour, the crew from the Pod Save America podcast are touring the same four cities. And John Lovett will be my guest on If You're Listening on Tuesday. We'll be back to talking about things that are happening now rather than things that are happening or not happening in the future. John and I will discuss the significance of the events in Minneapolis, Minnesota over the last few weeks. And then on Thursday, we'll be looking at the man who's been the primary driver behind the Trump administration's immigration policies, Stephen Miller. Thanks for listening. I'll see you soon.